a gun.
Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee.
This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Hello, hello. This is Zane Adams with the Texas Warbird Report. Welcome in season number 2, episode 12 here. We've been at this about a year now with the Texas Warbird Report, and this is our 12th episode, not counting Christmas parties and the such with Matt on the regular Warbird radio shows, but we're raring to go. It's January 26, 2016. I hope everybody had a happy new year. We are here in the great state of Texas. I'm up here in the north Texas in the DFW area, and for all of you folks listening on the East Coast and up north, it's going to be sunny and 70-plus degrees this weekend, so eat your heart out. Come to Texas and enjoy the winters. But summer's a little tough, but, you know, here we are. There's a lot going on in the state of Texas. This is, air show season's over, just like most of the country, and annuals are going on. Ground schools are happening. I know the FIFI, the CAF B-29 squadron, the ground school happened last weekend, and they are getting ready to go. They're going to be out on tour, and starting in February, I believe, they're going to the southeast part of the country and tour around in the warmer climes out there in Florida and points beyond. And then I know the A-26K squadron, the guys over there with the A-26K in Fort Worth got their new plexiglass this weekend. I think they got it ready to go on that airplane, making small steps, but it's sure to be a winner when it comes out. The last time I talked to those guys, they were hoping to get it to that little air show in Wisconsin this summer. And hopefully that will happen. I know there's another Texas guy. Speaking of that little air show in Wisconsin, there's another Texas guy that has a little thing called an A-20 out there, Havoc, and supposedly it's their goal to take that to that little air show. And those guys are in South Texas, and there's just all kinds of things going on in this state here. I know I don't know if you guys follow EZL Aviation, they've got a nice little Facebook page there, and Nelson and the gang out there do wonderful work. They do a lot of Warbird restoration. They've got some serious projects going on that they teased us over here in the last week or two. A full-up Bearcat restoration. They've got the Brewster Corsair that they're still working on. It's full, body-off restoration, as they call it in the car business. And they're working on Sea Fury, Mustang Millie G's there. There's a Temco Pinto. Of all kinds of things there. They're working on the Lone Star Flight Museum's P-47. So they've got a lot going on there. And plus, one of the other things that we get little glimpses of out of EZL is Nelson's Tempest. He's got a Hawker Tempest that he's been working on for years and years. Those that follow Warbirds know that he's got one down there. And it looks like from the pictures he posted over Christmas, just after Christmas here, that it looks like the fuselage is almost done, at least skin work and things. But that's his private project, so he doesn't get paid to work on it. So it just gets attention when he's got time. But look at their EZL Aviation on Facebook, and you'll see some of the pictures and the great stuff they're doing there here in the great state of Texas. But another thing in Texas, our guest tonight, Rick Sharp. Rick, are you there?
Oh, yeah.
Well, Rick is a Houston guy. Sorry about that from us North Texas folks. But and he's the founder of the Vietnam War Flight Museum down there in Houston, based at Ellington Field, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And I know you share your aircraft. So people want to see your airplanes, aircraft sometimes there at the Lone Star Flight Museum. And, of course, the Lone Star Flight Museum is going to come to you pretty soon, apparently, there at Ellington. So Ellington's going to be quite the mecca for warbirds, and especially you guys, you and the Collings Foundation with your fast jets and your Vietnam era stuff. And so tell us a little bit about your museum and where this idea and you know the groundswell came from for that.
Well, I've always thought that whatever we do for the Vietnam vets, we're doing way too little, way too late. Those guys did a great job. And just like George Washington said, the ability to get young men to fight our future wars is directly proportional to how they perceive veterans from previous wars have been treated. So I think it's really important to honor the Vietnam vets. And they have every bit as much right as the World War II vets had to see the aircraft that they fought in, that they serviced, that helped them out fly. So in 2002, we got our first aircraft, the Skyraider, and we were very proud of it, and it just kind of took off from there. One of the aircraft that we just added to the museum collection that we're very proud of is a actual Chinese MiG-15, even though it's not Vietnam, it's prelude to Vietnam. But anyway, it's a Chinese MiG-15 that actually has Korean War history.
Oh, really? Is that the red one?
Yes. So, no, that's a MiG-17.
Oh, okay.
So with this MiG-15, it gives us, I think we're the only museum around now that has a flyable MiG-21, MiG-17, and MiG-15. Even though those aren't U.S. aircraft, they were the nemesis. They're a very historically important aircraft.
Sure.
The MiG-15 really set the Western world back. The U.S. would have never sent F-86s to Korea had it not been for the MiG-15. They thought they had air superiority until the MiG-15 showed up.
And then Mustangs and Corsairs weren't enough.
There was nothing to counteract the MiG-15 over in Korea. The Great Britain had nothing that could stand toe-to-toe with it. The French had nothing that could stand toe-to-toe with it. Only the American F-86 could be a nemesis to the MiG-15.
And so yours is a Chinese version. It's not one of the Polish guys or something.
Nope. It's a Chinese MiG-15. All the Chinese MiG-15s were actually built in Russia. They were sold to the Chinese. The Chinese rebuilt them. And that's what started the Chinese aircraft industry. Later on, they built their own MiG-17s. They built their own MiG-21s, MiG-19s. But the MiG-15s that the Chinese had in Korea were all Russian built.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. I figured it was one of those trade-off deals, and they built their own. But now that's interesting. I didn't know that. So, but it does have some Korean War history. Where does that provenance come from? How do you figure that out? Because
we actually have the Iron Curtain on that aircraft from day one, which is pretty rare to have on an aircraft like that. But we have the logbooks from day one.
Oh, well, that's cool. That's very rare, especially, like I said, those whether you call them your communist bloc countries, you know, that information could become hard to come by. So you're very fortunate to have that.
So we were kind of glad to get that. There's a few aircraft that are on our want list. We'd love to have an H-34. We'd love to have a B-57.
Yeah.
And we'd love to have an F-5 someday.
So there's a few H-34s around that are still flying. I guess they're pretty rare with the radial on it up though.
They're getting to be harder and harder to find.
Yeah. And I know there's a couple.
The H-34 was really the mainstay for the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
They only had 125 Hueys that ever went into country, and the H-34 was really the mainstay for the Marine Corps.
Well, that's cool. Do you have your eyeball on one, or is it just on the wish list?
Well, there's two in Oklahoma that we're talking to one of the owners. We'd certainly like to come by one of those, and if anybody has any ideas, we're certainly any of your listeners have any ideas, we're certainly amicable to taking any type of serious flyable H-34 in consideration.
Sure. Well, that's good to hear. That'd be neat to see, because there's, I don't believe, I don't know, I hadn't followed them, don't follow the helicopters that closely, but there's, I don't believe there's one on the Warbird circuit that I know of.
There's not. The last one, they actually donated to the Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, and the aircraft is on permanent static display now.
Well, there you go. So you would, that'd be quite the coup then.
Well, we'd certainly like to have one.
Well, other aircraft you've got in your stable there, I know you've got the A-26, which is a multi-war airplane, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and beyond. And I know do you still have two, or you traded one out for the other?
We do. We have two of them. We've got the Fire Eaters A-26, which was in the movie Always, that belonged to Denny Lynch. Denny Lynch actually got it from Sperplot and had the airplane until he died, and Randy Lynch, his son, sold the airplane to a man in Georgia for a short period of time, and then we acquired the aircraft. And the other aircraft we have is the one that Bob Pond owned for so many years, and we got it from Bob Pond's estate.
Oh, they're beautiful airplanes, and it was cool to see the Fire Eater. I know you. Everybody wants to know, you know, are you going to keep it that? Are you doing something else with it? What are your plans?
Fire Eaters has its own identity because of the movie. And so I think we'll probably leave it just the way it is. And we've just got finished recovering the control surfaces on it. Tim Rule and Al Maxwell have worked real hard on it. And Tom Newton, he has been working very diligently on the A-26 in Galveston, Guns for Hire, Millionaire, Roger Woolsey with the Millionaire chain that sponsored it, so it's Miss Millionaire. But without Tom and Tim and Al and a lot of the volunteers, there's just no way that we could ever do this.
Well, and it does, any kind of museum, anything, any worthwhile deal like this, especially with aviation, it does come down to the volunteers, those that come out and give of their time and to work hard. And I know you guys, you don't have a building as such as a museum should. And I guess that's in the plans, but you know, if you've got people there in Houston area, how would you suggest they get a hold of you if they've got knowledge, got or want to help or want to come sweep floors or whatever?
They can always reach us through my cell phone number, and it's basically on our website. That's 713-213-8454. They can call me at any time. We'd be glad to have as many volunteers as we can get. Tom Newton really does all the volunteer coordination and maintenance coordination, especially for the piston aircraft. And Tom has been working diligently to replace two engines on Miss Millionaire, which I think they're going to run it probably, if not this weekend, the next weekend. And the Sky Raider actually needs to be woken up for the air show season, so we'll start working on it pretty quick. It's quite a task to keep that many aircraft going.
Oh yeah, it is, and I know there was and the jets are a little different than the piston airplanes. I know, or at least the turbine aircraft. The MiGs and the Huey and the Cobra. What's the difference between, you know, basically maintaining and flying the turbine aircraft versus the piston aircraft?
Well, with the helicopters, it's a lot less work with the engine, but of course, the airframe on a helicopter requires so much more work than a piston aircraft, or so much more work than a propeller aircraft because of the rotables. And when we get into the jet aircraft, they take a lot of specialized equipment. We were very fortunate with the MiG-21 that when Oscar Vickery donated us the MiG-21, he also had a large collection of support equipment. And when we bought the MiG-15, we got quite a bit of support equipment that came with the MiG-15. The MiG-17, we pretty much just had an airplane, but the 15 and 17 share so much of the equipment that it makes it very easy. So at least we've got the equipment to continue to operate these aircraft for quite a while.
Yeah. And the MiG, it doesn't fly too often. I know it takes some gumption to fly it anyway, and a lot of gas. I know it. Those things are notorious for running out of gas about the time you hit the pattern. And you flew it in 2014 at the Wings Over Houston Air Show. And how often is that the last time it's flown, or do you fly that here and there, or when it's called for at an air show? Or
we've flown it since then, but it really has. There had been a lot of demand for it. We have a load in it, so we can actually do training in the MiG-21. But there has been a lot of demand for training in the MiG-21, and so it hasn't flown a lot this year. We were working on other projects. The MiG-15 was really high on our list, and it took quite a bit because the MiG-15 hadn't flown for 20 years. It was located in St. Louis, so it was a long ways away from home, and it took a while to get it flyable. So that was really kind of high on our priority list, since it was such a special aircraft in combat history.
Sure. Well, so tell us about the MiG-21 as far as where it came from, and tell us a little bit about, walk us through a trip around the patch in it.
Well, our MiG-21 was donated by Oscar Vickery. Oscar had lost his medical, and he had lost his wife, and couldn't support the aircraft anymore. It had a few problems when we got it. We wound up changing the afterburner fuel controller, the main fuel controller, the fuel control boost pump. We had the engine out. Went through the aircraft, of course, had to pull the ejection seats out and had been checked over. The aircraft is quite an aircraft. It's even by today's standard, it is a fast aircraft. It's comparable to any of the Century Series aircraft, even though it's got boundary layer control and it lowers the approach speed. Still about the lowest approach speed you'll see is 165 knots on final.
Things happen in a hurry.
it does, and you're actually touching down at that speed. It's a delta wing airplane, so it's like the A-4. You're pretty much flying it all the way down to a touchdown. I did the scenario for around the pattern. You pretty much have to be mentally ready and your mind focused on exactly how you're going to do everything before you shove the throttles forward and light the burner, because it's going to happen quick. So you get lined up with the runway, throttle at 100%. What I do is release the brakes just for a second to make sure we're going straight. You want to engage the burner. As soon as you feel the burner light, then there'll be no doubt that when it lights, the aircraft is going to accelerate very quickly. You will pull the nose up at about 120 knots. The aircraft is going to leave the ground between 180 and 200 knots. It's not going to be flying very well at that. It's kind of wobbling around. You'll retract the gear. You'll start to feel the aircraft kind of get under control as it accelerates through about 250 knots. At 250 knots, it's a good time to retract the flaps. And then it'll accelerate extremely quick to 300 knots. At 300 knots, you can disengage the burner. I notice that when most people pull it out of burner, they will just stop for a second at 100% thrust, because as soon as you pull it out of burner, you kind of feel yourself go up against the straps. It's not because you're decelerating. It's just you're not accelerating like an ICBM. So
not going as fast.
You can really feel like you're slowing down, but you're not. And if you don't really pay attention, you need to kind of pull it back to fly to idle. And then running it back up to about 90% to sustain 300 knots. If not, you'll be going 400 knots before you notice it. It accelerates extremely quick.
So before you ever get the flaps up, you're breaking the Uncle Sam's speed limit.
Not really, because it's operational consideration. That is an operational. You are restricted by the flight manual. You cannot disengage the burner until you're doing at least 300 knots. And they do that because if your burner nozzle doesn't close, you won't have enough energy to get the airplane back around and land it.
Ah, I see. That makes sense. Yeah. So you're the fastest thing in the air, pretty much, when you're running around out there, other than your current military friends. But and I know you fly in and out of Houston where they understand this thing, but do you ever fly it to a field where they don't quite understand what you've got?
You know, we try not to. The main thing, and of course with the Collings Foundation too, what we explain to people is that we're really operating on the fringe of what's allowed in civilian aviation. And you really don't want to be on the radar. You want to be under the radar.
Right.
And so the way I kind of explain it to people is somebody walks into the local FAA office 2 weeks from now and said, "Hey, you know what? Rick Sharp was flying a MiG-21 around the other day." They should say two things. Number one, there's a MiG-21 in the area. And number two, who the heck is Rick Sharp? If they say that, I have really accomplished what I set out to accomplish.
There you go. You're not a charter member of the Friendly Aviator Association then, huh?
you want to be under the radar unless you're going to an air show where you're displaying the aircraft.
Yeah.
That's the only time you really want to be seen.
Right.
The more the FAA gets complaints about the speed, the noise, that's not a good thing.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, you got to be smart about it. You can't go out and buzz grandma's house in it for sure.
Exactly. And that's not being a good steward of a museum aircraft.
Of course. Not that I would recommend anybody go out and buzz grandma's house, 152 or MiG-21, but yeah, sounds like a hoot, Rick. It'd be hard to get ready. I know. And you say if you got a letter, you can do some flight training in that. I mean, like me, I'm a, you know, private pilot with a, you know, one, you know, 72 experience. You know, I know us guys can't necessarily handle that. We don't have the turbine ticket to begin with, and we don't have the mindset. But, you know, how do you get – has there been people that have flown that's not up to that speed and – takes them a while, or I mean, that you go through a MiG-15 or something first and then get there?
Well, it's pilots are not born, they're trained. And so as long as somebody has the credentials, everybody is a potential student. I mean, you can be trained to fly these aircraft.
Right.
That's what we do. And of course the Collings Foundation has the same thing with the A4 and the F4, they're working on a LOTA for the F100 and the T-33, but yeah, it's just a matter of training.
Yeah.
Larry Selganik has of course been doing it quite well for years.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely a wicked looking machine, but now on the other end of the spectrum, the Vietnam spectrum, you guys operate a Huey. And yes. It's got a little history as well.
Yeah, our Huey is actually an HH-1K. It was one of the six that went to Vietnam. It's actually got Vietnam history also. When we painted the aircraft, we thought, okay, well, the Navy had six of these gunships, the HH-1Ks. The Army operated about 7,000 of them. You know, what more represents the Vietnam War. So we actually put it in Army livery, but it is actually an HH-1K.
And so it's spent time in Southeast Asia. Was it a gunship or was it a slick or do you
it
know?
It was a gunship. Yeah, okay. The Navy used them for gun patrol, and they also used them for insertions.
Do you have gun rigs to throw on there? Or is that something you're working on?
We don't. I wish I did, but it's just like the Collings H-1E. We don't have any. It makes it a little tough too when you have the gun rig on it, because you really can't use the ground handling wheels, and that's very tough to move it in and out of the hangar.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, it's a good looking helicopter, and I enjoyed. I really enjoy the Wings Over Houston, the Vietnam element that you guys and Ralph and all put together down there, and it was a lot of fun to see the two Hueys, yours and the Collings Foundation, and the Cobra out beating up the field during the air show. And you know, do you guys campaign the UH-1 around the Huey around some at? Do you have a ride letter, authorization letter, or anything for that?
We don't. In the Vietnam War Flight Museum, of course, Collings Foundation does.
Right.
And they do more touring than we do, simply because of that. But the helicopters, most people don't realize how expensive it is to take a helicopter someplace. You know, the Sky Raider will get 2 miles to the gallon. A helicopter, a Huey or a Cobra, gets 1 mile to the gallon. It costs as much to move that helicopter from point A to point B as it does a B-17 almost.
Yeah.
That's kind of mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
But it's very expensive to move the helicopter. So I think that's why the helicopters are pretty much regional.
Yeah.
You know, when you have an air show, they just, it's very difficult to move a helicopter across country for a show. It's just cost prohibitive.
Yeah, well, and you've got time limited parts, your rotor blades and these kinds of things. I know Rick Harris is always counting the minutes on the blades on their Huey, and I know that those blades and those kinds of parts, those consumables, you know, time limited parts are harder and harder to find. And you know, I know there's some differences between the Huey and the Cobra, I mean, think you're going to be limited in the future with those parts?
You know, I think there's the Huey blades now. The gunship blades are getting to be extremely hard to find. You know, the gunships are short-bottomed helicopters. They have the 540 rotor system. They use the Dash 5 blade, which is an extremely wide blade cord. They were only brand new. They're good for 1,100 hours, so it's really a problem. There's not that many gunship Hueys flying in the world today, so I think the ones that are flying are in South America. So Bella's not really, they're not too keen on tooling up and building a lot of these rotor blades. You're probably looking at a year, 18, get a rotor blade. And if they did tool up, I would imagine it would be $80,000, $90,000 a blade.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So that's really a problem. That's why we try to really make it worthwhile when we're putting blade time on them. The Cobra, thank goodness, we have the composite blades on it, and they're good for 14,000 hours. So,
wow.
But yeah, it's like everything else, though. How many times will it go into the blade shop to be rebuilt before the 14,000 hours? You always have a little delamination problem or, you know, leading edge separation. It seems like it's always something where they're going into the shop for the composite blade. So
yeah,
it still gets expensive.
Sure. Yeah. And you don't want to, like you said, that's why you're regional. You can't really burn your blade time, you know, traveling to California or something for a show or anything else. Of course, you know, cost wise, I can't imagine that a show would, you know, too far away would want you to come. I know the guys up here in Lancaster that run the Colware Museum, guys that run the Hines, you know, they have people apparently want them to come, but when they hear the price of the gas and everything else that's built into that appearance, it's not easy for sure, especially in a helicopter, especially when you're only doing 100 and some odd knots. And
I mean, it's as expensive as the jets.
Yeah.
And the jets get very cost prohibitive.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, do a training sortie in the F-100, and you're going to go through 900 gallons.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's another thing we get to here. You fly with the Collings Foundation, some of their jets. I know you were flying the Mustang last March on part of the tour here from Dallas back to Houston and that kind of thing. And you're – what are you current on with the Collings guys? Are you – is it just the F-100 and the A-4 or –
I try to help them out, and I try to stay current in the, of course, their Huey. and the F-100, the A-4, the T-33, the 262, and their B-25 and B-24.
That's wearing a lot of hats.
Yeah, it is. And what they'll do is if they have a problem or somebody drops out and I'm available, of course, I'll be glad to drop everything and try to go to wherever they are and help them out.
Yeah.
But Rob Collins has been a great friend for a long time. And between the Collins Foundation and our museum, I think we've got the largest collection of Vietnam-era flyable aircraft in the world.
And they're all right there in Houston.
They are.
That's a pretty cool thing to think about, you know. And I know that, you know, the Collins guys, you're not checked out in the F-4 then.
No, and that would never happen. There's so many guys that are younger than I am that have so many hours in the F-4 that flew in the QF program. And,
yeah.
And you know, very talented guys.
Yeah, I know that. I was talking to Rick the other day, and Colonel Karg is, I guess, number 4 on their list, and he's a pretty current Air Force guy.
Yes. And then they're great guys. They flew in the QF program, and, you know, I mean, you've got people like of course, Gary Kirby, who is he maintains his low-level acro card in the F-4.
Yeah. And they're getting ready to fly again. I go, yep. No, Rick's chasing leaks and small stuff, but it's close.
They are a very dedicated crew, and it takes that because these jets, these were cutting-edge performance aircraft not too long ago.
Yeah.
And even though technology has passed them up as far as electronics and everything, aerodynamically and the operating envelope these aircraft operate in, you know, they're still right up there. They're still very formidable aircraft in today's world.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to treat them as such, too.
There's a reason A-4s are still under contract and doing dissimilar aircraft, combat kind of training all over the world, and especially here in the United States. You know, the small, nimble little aircraft is representative of what our guys might just face out there someplace. And it's, you know, so there's a lot of A-4s out there running that kind of training. And I know the Collins Foundation A-4, it's a beautiful airplane, and they fly it fairly regular, from what I understand, a little more than the F-4 and the F-100. And that airplane, it looks like a lot of fun.
The A-4 is just an unbelievably fine flying aircraft. It, delta wing airplane, there's a lot to be learned. You know, when you take somebody up and train them, I mean, when I say a lot to be learned, there's a lot to learn from the aircraft being a delta wing airplane, the flight characteristics of it. Delta wings fly a little bit different than other aircraft, and it's a good aeronautical experience to fly a delta wing airplane.
Yeah, I can imagine. And the A-4, Harry, just recently I read an article online that you did, and you're talking about operating these jets, and we're talking about the age of the jet is not necessarily, maybe not be the problem in the future. You know, I mean, it may be the age of some of the parts and these kinds of things, you know, seats and maybe engines for the F-4 and these kind of things, but the pilots is a little bit of a concern going forward. Like you were saying, you know, checking out in the F-100, the cost in that. And, you know, I know in, 2014, you and I guess Gumby checked out in the F-100. And, you know, what's Charlie Friend was, I guess, the last guy current. And so you had to kind of learn from him. And, you know, these kinds of training flight training hurdles are a little tough.
Oh, yeah, we were extremely fortunate that we had a guy like Charlie Friend who had over 3,000 hours in F-100s, you know, that we could draw from that experience. And unfortunately, you know, Charlie is, I think he's 74 now. Yeah. And so, you know, he's for flying an F-100, he's getting up there in the years. He's still in good shape, thank goodness. But, you know, going forward, we're thinking, okay, if it's not like the P-51 where the younger guys could come in and it was expensive. It was still expensive, but you know, you're talking about $10,000-$12,000 worth of training rather than $40,000 or $50,000 worth of training.
Yeah, right.
So it's getting really hard to entice people to come into the organization and want to get checked out in one of these aircraft and pay the amount of money that it takes to get checked out in it.
Yeah, you got half a house or a nice car invested in that kind of training.
It really is. And it was getting hard, you know, 25 years ago, the CAF looked at the same thing. They said, wow, all our guys that flew these airplanes in World War II, they're getting a little older. You know, how can we do this? And so they started putting a real push on training. And I say the CAF because they were, you know, 30 years ago, they were in town. Especially
right.
40 years ago. So they really, really pioneered that. We need to get guys in here. I know we're not running a school for this, but they instituted a sponsorship program. They said, okay, if guys want to come in, you know, we'll run clinics and classes for formation and for a T-6 school. And they did that. And, you know, we really need to kind of think about that on these jets if we want these things to continue to fly in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little tough road to hoe, that's for sure. And
It is.
Well, Rick, if you want to hang on just a second, we're going to take a quick break so I can refresh my iced tea glass here and give us a little commercial break so we can pay our bills. And we'll be right back in just a minute with Rick Sharp.
We're so close to the Pentagon. Sometimes they ask us to get the coffee. This is Warbird Radio.
Hey, thanks for tuning in to the all-new Warbird Radio Live channel. We're happy to be back on the air right across from the runway at Washington Reagan International Airport. Be sure and tune in Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern each week for Warbird Radio Live, followed by a new episode of one of our top-tier shows like the R.C. Scale Builder Show, Hartman and Hines, Over the Front, and the all-new Texas Warbird Report and Wings Over New Zealand Show. Listen, this station is all about community, so please join up with us on Tuesday nights and call in and become part of the fun and part of the family. Thanks again for tuning in, and join us Tuesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern.
Live from Washington, D.C., this is Warbird Radio.
Welcome back to the Texas Warbird Report here on Warbird Radio. This is episode 12, January of 2016, and we're talking with Rick Sharp from the Vietnam War Flight Museum out of Houston, Texas, and talking old jets and helicopters and old piston airplanes and these kinds of things. But, Rick, you still with us?
Oh, yes, sir.
All right. So tell us, Rick, I teased it a little bit online on Facebook. What's it like to fly a Cobra? I know there's not that many people out there in the private, outside the military that are flying these things. And it was quite the coup, I guess, when that came around and arrived. And it's really cool to see. And tell us a little bit about the Cobra and how you fell into being able to fly the thing and what it's like.
Well, the Cobra is an amazing helicopter, because it was the first helicopter that was really designed as an attack helicopter. The rest of them were utility helicopters that they, you know, figured out a way to put guns on and use, just like the Huey. But the Cobra was a single-purpose helicopter. It is there for one reason. It is there to support the ground troops and to bring the battle to the enemy. The Cobra does a great job with it. It carries a lot of armament. It's fast. The world's record for a helicopter is 250 miles an hour, which was just set a few years ago. That Cobra, when it came out, and this is a 1967 design,
yeah,
when that helicopter came out, it could do 213 miles an hour, 190 knots. Now, when you think about it, that was blazing fast for the day. It has a very small frontal area. There's no armament on the helicopter. Like all helicopters, they build them as light as they can because a helicopter takes, usually a helicopter, it's 80% of its maximum available power just to hover.
Yeah.
And at gross weights, you're using 100%. Sometimes they won't even hover. A lot of the gunships wouldn't hover when they were fully loaded. So,
and it's scrape the scoot the skids along the ground and you get a little airspeed, yeah.
Right, right, and getting translational lift.
Yeah.
But so this helicopter, to keep it light, there's no armament. The way this helicopter eludes fire is that if you look at it from the front, it has an extremely skinny profile. It's a small target.
Yeah.
So it carries a lot of armament. It's a small target. It goes very fast. Sitting in the gunner seat in the front is really kind of neat because you feel like you're in the X-Fighter. You're up front. There's no obstruction to visibility. You've got the side controls, which is kind of neat. It's pretty tricky when you're flying the cyclic with the side control, but you know, once you get used to it, it is a neat helicopter. That engineering, unbelievable for the time.
So it's a dual control helicopter?
And it is a beautiful flying helicopter.
Okay.
Yes, especially the one we have. We've got a TAH-1P. The difference was you actually have boosted controls in the front where you could the instructor could overpower the student if he had to, you know, for the controls. So it is a just an unbelievably fine flying helicopter. Tober was a great helicopter.
Yeah, it's a lot more maneuverable than the Huey, I suppose. And of course, you got. What do you have? About the same power, or has it got more power than the Huey? How's that work?
Well, you've got your limitations because you have a teeter totter rotor system. So just like the Huey, it'll take no zero or negative G's. You could snap
right.
The mast off in a heartbeat. But because of that, because the rotor system is teeter tottering, and for a gun platform now. It's you have to kind of picture that a helicopter with a teeter-totter rotor system, as the rotor system is moving, your cab is kind of suspended by the rotor system, so it's sitting under it like a gondola. So it's stable while the rotor system moves, unlike a semi-rigid rotor system where the whole helicopter is moving. So for a gun platform, as you're sitting there with the rotor system trying to keep the helicopter in one spot, your aiming platform is remaining stable. That was a big advantage of the Cobra.
Yeah. Cool. And normal armament on that was what? There was 20-millimeter gun up front. Is that right?
Well, they had many packages. You could have a 7.62 mini guns up front. You could have the three-barreled Vulcan 20 millimeter, which is what ours has. And it could carry an array of rockets and armament on the wings. One of the biggest, of course, during the Vietnam War was the TOW missile, which is a wire-guided missile.
And that all of that handled the guy up front. The guy in the back does the flying, and the guy up front puts it all on target.
That's it.
Just like the Apache and everything else still today. So,
right. He's directing the fire. He's up there with unlimited visibility. He is sighting in on the target, and he fires.
Yeah.
Ours, the way we've got it equipped, we've got a 219 and 211 pod, 2.75 rocket pods on each wing.
So how the fire control for the guy in the front, was that helmet-based like it is nowadays, even back originally? Or
the later model Cobras were helmet-based. They actually have a towel rack. We call it the towel rack that runs through the cockpit that's connected to the helmet. And yeah, it was pretty amazing. I remember when the Guard unit had those, they had them as late as, I believe, 96. But I remember in the 90s, they would come in and you'd see the guy in the front wagging his head and you can watch the gun. It's, I mean, amazingly quick. their electric motors on the 20 millimeters. I mean, they would move extremely quick with his line of sight.
It's a cool machine for sure. It's a lot of fun to watch it fly. So
a piece of history. I mean, it was designed during the Vietnam War, for the Vietnam War. It was the Army's first dedicated attack helicopter, and it, by today's standards, it's still a good machine. Marines still use it.
Yep. Yeah. They're there on the whiskey, I guess now. So.
Right.
Yep. Yeah. So whiskey a little bit about a little. I'm sorry.
Yeah, whiskey and Zulu models.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. There you go. It's a considerably larger airplane or helicopter. They have twin engine and everything else on them nowadays. So.
The body and what they will carry is it's a lot more, of course, than the Army did. It was in fact they've got as much on one engine as the 703 had. 703 is an 1800 horsepower engine, and the Whiskey model has they've got 1800 horsepower per side.
Got plenty of juice there for sure. Well, a lot more weight, but still, you know. So tell us a little bit about Rick Sharp. What do you fly for fun on the weekends? And where did you come from in this warbird world?
You know, I started in the CAF in 1979. I joined the CAF. I was flying a Japanese dive bomber and started flying Tora. I was fortunate enough to fly the CAF Hellcat and flew the Corsair and the P-51, and I've been involved in the warbirds since 1979.
Yeah, that's a ways back. I guess my first trip to the Valley was in maybe 76 or so, but I know I was down there 79, 80, 82, 85, some, you know, those every couple of years would make it down there for the big air show. So I guess saw you out there flying that in the Tora then. Well, that's cool.
Yeah, that was quite a group back then, and of course that was quite an air show. It was a 4-day air show in Harlingen because there was nothing else like it at the time.
Oh no, yeah, I know the guys. Canadians would come down. People come from the West Coast. There were warbirds everywhere, from everywhere.
Yeah, Paul Tibbetts was there. Adolph Gollum. I was fortunate enough to be checked out in the Hellcat by Archie Donahue.
Cool.
No, it was something else back then. It really was.
Yeah, CF's a completely different organization than it nowadays as it was in a lot of respects, and there was a lot of tongue in cheek. But I know things in the Valley at Harlingen during the air shows were quite rambunctious and a whole lot of fun for the CAF guys. And you must have been a young guy back then, huh?
I was, and you know when you look at it, when you think about. You know, Lloyd Nolan and Lefty Gardner, these were not wealthy people. They just had an idea. They were dedicated. It was something they wanted to do. And, you know, they had a spirit and resolve that was unmatched for the time.
Yeah. And they always seemed to have a great time, seemed to have a smile on their face. And a few times I met Lefty he was always a super nice guy. And you know, like you were saying, I guess you were one of the young guys when they started looking at the old guys, even back then, that you know needed some fresh blood in the organization, and they're still doing a good job with that, I think.
Yeah, they do. They really do. They have always enticed younger guys, and even Steve Brown, he had made the comment that he really wanted younger guys flying the aircraft to continue it on. He does get that.
Yep. Well, and I know there's a lot of young guys flying with them now, and you know, you've got your T6 Mafia, your Trey Don Carrolls and Taylor Stevensons, and those guys that are they're CAF kids, and they're coming up and starting to fly some of these things a little bit, and you know, Mark Todd and those guys, they're all youngsters, and. You know, flying with those guys a little. I know that buddy Steve Swift up here has flown Fifi, and you know, and he was just a punk kid running around Doc Hosper's hangar, you know, when I was messing around with them guys. So, you know, it's cool to see these youngsters, these young guys getting up there. I mean, I'm only 50, so I'm still a young guy, I guess, but, still it's cool. And of course, you know, a lot of people, it's hard to believe they're that young flying these things, but the guys that flew these things in service, your Vietnam vets, were only in their 20s when they were doing this kind of stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And some of them even younger than that. You know, when if you went through the NAVROC program or when it was available, it, you know, it was 2 years in college, and you could be 19 years old and going through flight school. And you had some of that during the war. You really did.
Yep. Yep. It was amazing.
A lot of guys flying helicopters were—they were fresh out of high school.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
going to Fort Walters and
exactly.
Then to Fort Walters and then off to Rucker and straight to country.
Yep, yep, yep. Well, and folks that want to visit you guys by appointment, this kind of thing.
The easiest way to see the aircraft, of course, we had a long-standing partnership with the Lone Star Flight Museum. And of course, Larry Gregory and Tommy Gregory, I flew with their father in tour. I've known those guys for most of their lives. You know, we've been friends for a long, long time. And we maintain about 5 aircraft at the Lone Star Flight Museum in Galveston at all times. So.
Well, there you go. I think that's where I've seen most of your stuff when it's not at an air show. So.
We're very proud to have the airplanes on display down there where people can view them, you know, 364 days a year.
Yeah. Well, I commend you for helping the veterans, the Vietnam veterans. I do believe that a lot of this stuff gets lost and forgotten, and those guys certainly don't need to be forgotten. I know I've said it many times, you know, when I crewed with this Texas Air Command Museum up here, had that Huey, and we went to an air show and a guy sat down on the deck and started crying, and you know, we were just kind of standing around going, what's going on with this guy? And he said, the last time I touched a Huey, is it saved my ass and drug me out of the jungle and got me to the hospital. And even those guys that didn't fly, certainly, you know, the Huey, the Cobras, even the Sky Raiders doing close air support and that kind of stuff, you know, a lot of them owe their lives, to these machines, which is kind of an odd thing to say, but, it's the truth. And, you know, I commend you for the angle you're taking at it here, Rick.
Well, we're trying, we really are. And, you know, it's really about the veterans. I can remember one time we had the Sky Raider at Lone Star Flight Museum in Galveston. We brought it out just to run it up. And this young lady, she was absolutely very emotional. She wanted to see that airplane more than anything. Come to find out, her father was in the 602nd, the same that our aircraft is marked in. He was in the Special Operations Wing and the same squadron that our aircraft has the markings of, and she never got to meet her father because her father shipped out while her mother was pregnant with her, and he was lost over Laos in 1970. So, that's a very emotional thing when we're able to you know, they're able to see it, touch it, see what their father did. It's very, very rewarding to be able to do that for people.
Sure. It is. Well, good job, Rick. People can visit you at VietnamWarFlight.com. There's a link on the Warbird Radio, Texas Warbird Report homepage there on WarbirdRadio.com. And, Rick, I really appreciate you being on with us tonight, taking your time out on a weeknight here to talk airplanes with us. And, you know, I certainly look forward to seeing you again around. I don't know if you're going to be up here with the Collings Foundation in March. If you are, I'm going to stop by and say hello. I always hang out with those guys a little bit while they're in Dallas, and hope to see you soon, and appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thanks, Rick. That's Rick Sharp from the Vietnam War Flight Museum out of Houston, Texas. Wraps up another show, the Texas Warbird Report, here on warbirdradio.com. The podcast will be up here soon, and I really appreciate you guys listening out there. Have a good evening. Support our veterans.